From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, President Trump said he will strongly consider testifying in writing in the impeachment inquiry, something Nancy Pelosi invited him to do yesterday. The House Intelligence Committee is gearing up for the second week of public hearings featuring current and former Trump administration officials. Trump attacked Democrats over the weekend, saying the inquiry had been rigged by House Speaker Pelosi. And Republicans flocked to the Sunday shows to make the case that while witnesses say a request for political investigations in exchange for aid or White House meeting did happen, the aid ultimately went through, so end of story. Tolu Olorunipa is White House reporter for the Washington Post. Hi, Tolu.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. And to the president's tweet today saying he may testify in writing, adding, even though I did nothing wrong and don't like giving credibility to this no due process hoax. Your thoughts?
We have heard the president float things in the past and then back down or just sort of throw them out there to get the media interested and to get headlines and then not follow through. So I would be surprised if the president does actually sit for testimony or even provide written answers, in part because his White House has been so antagonistic to this entire process, holding back key witnesses from testifying under oath. And the White House has not been able to provide a lot of answers to the Democrats that are trying to figure out what happened with Ukraine. But I think this latest float by the president shows that there is some concern within the White House that maybe they have not done enough to put out their own messaging to counter some of these officials who have come out and provided some damaging testimony about what the president was doing. And there is not very much of a counter narrative. So maybe this is the president trying to put that out there, that he would be willing to answer questions and show that in his mind he did nothing wrong.
Well, we'll get to one of the, you know, the latest counter narrative. But first, you know, what to expect this week. Eight witnesses scheduled to testify, including Ambassador Gordon Sondland, ambassador to the EU. He had many conversations with President Trump about Ukraine. Some were overheard. The Wall Street Journal is reporting today that emails show that he kept presidential aide Mick Mulvaney and Rick Perry abreast of his talks with Ukraine about trading aid for investigations. He notably changed his closed-door testimony to include more information about what he knew about that exchange or deal. What are Democrats hoping to hear from him?
Well, he is their key witness at this point, who could link all of this bad behavior that they have laid out to the president directly, because he had spoken several times with the president. He was carrying out Ukraine policy on behalf of the president, even though he was the ambassador to the European Union, which is not usually a position that would be in charge of Ukraine policy. So this irregular foreign policy making channel was led in part by Gordon Sondland, and he was, in his mind, doing it at the behest of President Trump. So if Democrats can make the connection between President Trump and all of this bad behavior, this quid pro quo between the Ukraine's government decision to hold investigations because President Trump wanted the Bidens to be investigated in exchange for taxpayer-funded military assistance, Gordon Sondland is the person who could provide that link.
Well, over the weekend, President Trump also renewed his calls to out what he called the fake whistleblower. He attacked Jennifer Williams, who he called an aide to Vice President Mike Pence. She's not. She's assigned to his office from the State Department. She described Trump's July 25th call with the Ukrainian president as inappropriate in closed-door hearings. Look, we also had the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine on Friday while she was testifying be attacked by the president in a tweet. She said in the middle of the hearing she felt intimidated. How is this playing out, the president attacking people who are testifying? Isn't that witness intimidation?
Well, it's definitely making it harder for Republicans to defend the underlying behavior of the president. They're having to shift their arguments to defending the live attacks by the president against witnesses. Now, Ambassador Yovanovitch, who was recalled from Ukraine by the president, did say that she felt intimidated by the president's tweets against her. And the president has shown no sign of slowing down. He's attacked other members of his own administration, calling them never Trumpers and saying that they are wrong to be testifying and participating in this process. So it does seem that the president will continue this this tactic of intimidating people who are going against him.
Well, briefly, we want to hear what the Republican lawmakers are saying. Here's Jim Jordan of Ohio on Face the Nation. He was asked about Trump's goal of having Ukraine investigate Biden's what Democrats are calling bribery. Let's listen.
There was never an investigation undertaken. There was never an announcement from
President
Zelensky. But
the request for one that was overheard and testified to.
But it didn't happen. Like, there's all kinds of talk about things, but it didn't happen.
So, Tolu, quickly, that defense, I mean, people are saying a burglar trying to break into a house is still a burglar.
Yeah, it's a hard defense to put forward by Republicans, in part because they're saying that what the president was requesting was wrong, just saying that he was not able to accomplish it. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a halfway defense, and the president has requested people to defend him fully, to say his call was perfect.
Right.
And right now we're not hearing that from Republicans.
No. Tolu Olorunipa, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thank you.
We want to turn now to Hong Kong, where there's a standoff between police and hundreds of protesters at Hong Kong Polytechnic University. This is the latest escalation in the anti-government demonstrations that have gripped Hong Kong for nearly 6 months now. NPR's Southeast Asia correspondent Julie McCarthy joins us from Hong Kong. Julie, can you explain what's going on there?
Well, at the moment, first of all, can I just tell you what's going on? In Kowloon, which is the area that's really become inflamed today, it's a battleground this evening. Parts, major roads, Jordan Road, Tsin Sha Tsui, Yamatai, they're laid waste. Fires are igniting. Tear gas canisters are rolling down the pavement. The protesters take up these positions, crouching beneath their umbrellas, and they advance as one, and then they move backwards as one. And, you know, behind them, someone's lobbing the gasoline bombs. They are undaunted, Tanya. Mm. And if threats about postponing the election, which we heard today, are meant to mean anything, I can tell you they're falling on deaf ears of protesters tonight.
Wow. I mean, you're giving us a vivid look at what's happening in the streets. At the Hong Kong Polytechnic University, I've seen pictures that are really surreal, people climbing and jumping out of windows during that standoff. Police have told protesters that there's only one way in and one way out. Has this turned into a siege?
Well, you know, the power arrayed against the protesters is no match for them. And the standoff was extraordinary to watch. The protesters don't seem to exhibit fear. They managed to organize garrisons where they stockpiled bricks and petrol bombs in sizable numbers. And they were able to hold these places for days. There was an agreement not to storm the place, but that fell apart, and the police attempted to. They were turned back by protesters who set fires to the, you know, barricaded entrances. So there's this steely determination, and you saw it tonight. Again, you saw it on the streets. People were being arrested, but they were certainly out in numbers that had riot police just in large phalanxes across the streets in major parts of Kowloon.
Is it really safe to say that police don't really have a strategy, or do they?
I think the idea here is to up the aggression. You know, it's a clear indication that Beijing wants this shut down, but locally, if possible. And that means more robust policing. So there's training that's sharpening this entire enterprise. And that's part of what you're seeing out there. You're also seeing the police responding to the acceleration and the escalation of violence on the part of protesters. It's this retaliatory spiral that's also part of this.
We've really been watching these protests for months now, and it seems that we hit a tipping point, and it seems like it's the worst that it has been, and then something else happens. Is it getting worse, and are people frustrated by the protests, their lives being disrupted?
Well, I don't think there's any question that this past week and this past weekend at Polytechnic University were the worst, most violent episodes in nearly 6 months of them. And you can view that in a couple ways, as I get saying, spiraling retaliation on the one hand, but also, you know, one of desperation. You know, protesters don't believe they're being listened to. They can't bend the government to see their point of view. So you keep yourself upping the ante. And they do that in the hope that they will be listened to. I think you also need to see this in the framework of two very opposite and antithetical viewpoints battling it out. The protesters want more democratic freedoms, less interference from Beijing. The institutions of government here are beholden to the central leadership in Beijing, and they do toe that line.
Yeah, you're in the thick of it. You've been covering this for quite a while. Do you see any way to end these protests peacefully?
Well, you know, there's talk this weekend that emerged. 400 officials and experts from outside came in here and convened about what to do. And what they were being told by outside experts is that you've got to dialogue. And in fact, you had some of them saying, what you really need to do first off is meet the demands. Which include an inquiry into the police and direct elections. You know, but to Western ears, that may make a lot of sense. To ears in Beijing, that involves great concessions. And if Xi Jinping is more concerned about control than amity and in saving Hong Kong, he doesn't grant them those concessions. It's a difficult way for them to think. They lose a lot of face in the middle of all that. So if you want to keep your hands off of Hong Kong means a little less of that rejuvenation of the motherland that Xi Jinping is trumpeting.
NPR Southeast Asia correspondent Julie McCarthy in Hong Kong. Julie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Here's a serious question. Who isn't fascinated by emperor penguins? I mean, every year they travel to their breeding grounds, and once the females lay their eggs, the males immediately take charge over them for over 100 days in the cold darkness of winter. Once the eggs hatch, the females return to take charge of the baby penguins. All of this in the harsh, brutal elements of Antarctica. This cycle is beautifully captured in the BBC documentary Dynasties, Emperor, narrated by David Attenborough.
Penguins unlucky in love head back to spend the winter feeding at sea because there's no food out here on the ice.
But have you ever wondered what's involved in making that kind of film? I certainly have. British wildlife filmmaker Lindsay McRae spent 11 months in Antarctica as the director of photography for Dynasties. He's now written about the experience in the new book, My Penguin Year, and he joins us to talk about it. Welcome, Lindsay.
Thank you very much.
So filming the emperor penguins was something that you've wanted to do for a long time, ever since you saw David Attenborough's wildlife series Planet Earth back in 2006. But traveling to Antarctica, that's some level of commitment. What drew you to this project?
Well, yeah, it was back during the first Planet Earth, which I remember watching the images of the camera person on his knees in the most brutal conditions and just being as far away from home as I could possibly get and experiencing probably the hardest conditions I'll ever experience. It's weird. It's those are the things that attracted me to it. And obviously you've got the payoff of watching Emperor Penguins for a year.
Yeah. So 11 months of filming, it's a lot to ask of any filmmaker, but you also had this other complication. You found out that your partner, Becky, was pregnant and that she was due to give birth while you were away, and you still decided to take the trip.
Well, I actually knew that I was going 2 years before we actually left, and we spoke long and hard about this. And it was either wait the 2 years of preparation and then the actual year I was away. So 3 years, a long time in total, or see what happens. And it was our first child, so we thought we'll go through it without knowing what to expect and see what happens. And little Walter was born in April, and I didn't meet him until he was 7 months old.
7 months old. I find it a little ironic, though, that you were on this filming trip, filming penguins going through this process of procreating. And meanwhile, Becky was back home, pregnant with your child. Was this something that you were thinking about as you were filming these penguins?
Well, no, it's funny. Not until they laid their eggs and the female passed the egg to the male. And then she turned around and walked away. And I remember she took one glance back at her partner. And then it dawned on me at how ironic this whole situation was, that female was me a few months back and I'd left Becky back at home.
Yeah, some of the filming
you also did was incredibly risky. One example is that you and your colleagues went out to film the male penguins weathering a winter storm. Getting back to the station turned out to really be incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, well, we and actually filming a storm was one of the things I was most excited about. I knew the weather would
really
be pretty. Yeah, because you're seeing behavior that even when the weather gets that bad, scientists turn and go for home because it is so dangerous. Mm-hmm. So it was an event, and emperor penguins are famed for this huddling behavior and withstanding these horrendous storms. And our colony was about 7 kilometers away from the research station, which was our home. You could do in 10 minutes on a good day. But yeah, we outstayed our welcome in one storm and we got some amazing images. But our journey home took us almost 3 hours. And you're simply just relying on that little GPS box in front of you. And it's terrifying because you can't see a thing because the visibility is zero. The wind is so strong, you're getting your skidoo's almost getting blown over. And you're just creeping along, hoping that the station's going to pop up in front of you. And
oh my God.
The one day we did have a really bad one, I only found out we were back is because I drove into it. You couldn't see it.
You drove right into the building. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. We were obviously just creeping along and yeah, I hit the front door. So yeah, they are horrendous conditions and yeah, incredibly dangerous.
I'm wondering if there were moments when you were tempted to intervene on behalf of the penguins. I'm thinking about this one scene where there was a huge gully near the penguins and a number of them were blown and fell into it. And you saw these little babies trying to get up the hill there. How did you feel and how did you react to those moments?
That had been probably the biggest storm we'd experienced. It was a good 2 week plus storm. We'd not been able to even open the front door to the station. We'd been with the birds about 10 months at this point, so we were really close to them. We'd spent every moment of the day, you know, good weather days with them. And yeah, when we returned after this storm, it was just carnage. There were baby penguins everywhere that had got separated from their parents, and there were parents looking for their young. And then there were these enormous gullies that had formed and lots of birds at the bottom of these gullies. And it was a real unique situation because they hadn't been chased in there by a predator. And if they would have died down there, there were no other animals in Antarctica at that time of year which would have benefited from feeding on a dead penguin. So yeah, we thought long and hard. We watched what was happening and, we decided to give them a helping hand. And we dug them a shallow ramp. We gave them an option. We didn't help them directly. But fortunately, they decided to use it and they saved themselves.
You know, it's really easy, you can hear it in my voice, to attach human emotions to penguins. But you spent a lot of time filming them. Would you say you saw moments of genuine emotion?
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember the first couple of penguins we saw, they turn around and walk away. And you could mistake them for people in suits. They're big animals and you can't help it. And they're monogamous, so they pair up anew each season. They don't go back to their old partner. But still, that bond, the strength of that bond is just incredible. But they need it to get their chick through the most horrendous conditions on Earth and get it to a stage where it can look after itself and fledge. So it is important.
There was one moment in your book, you had just arrived in Antarctica and you were sitting on the ice and a group of penguins saw you and your partner and came right on up to you with no fear. And I'm thinking about those moments of genuine emotion and friendliness. How would you describe that and their interactions with you guys?
Well, yeah, I'll never forget that because I'd never actually seen a penguin before, not even in a zoo back in the UK. And yeah, we took our first trip out onto the ice and very quickly this group of penguins spotted us. And a lot of these birds that we were filming had probably never seen a human before. So they've no real reason to be afraid of us. And they dropped to their bellies and tobogganed right over and they must have got within a couple of feet and they stood up and did their classic bow and then that amazing trumpet call, which just went right through me. It was just to hear it out in the wild was something else. We obviously had rules to stick to when we were filming about distances, but they were very hard to follow when each day you'd set the camera up and you'd turn around and there'd be a three asleep next to it. And I like to think that they liked our company as much as we liked theirs.
Yeah. Why do you think we care about penguins so much? There are so many stories about them, films, documentaries. We can't get enough of their stories.
No, I know. And it is strange. And I think I was like everybody else. I'd never seen one, but there was just something about them. Everybody across the world knows what an emperor penguin looks like. It's just got to be one of those animals. And when the chicks were born, they are the cutest things that I've ever seen. It's very easy to see why a lot of children's toys are based around baby emperor penguin chicks. But so few people get to see emperors, especially because they're so far south, get to see them in the wild.
You know, the life cycle of the emperor penguin is so unique. It's so dependent on the ice forming at a particular time. And you touched on this in your book. It makes them particularly vulnerable to climate change. Do you worry about their future?
Yeah, absolutely. Not for the species at the moment. It's more their habitat because they're relying on the ocean freezing. There are very few emperors which ever touch land. They spend their life on the sea. And even when they're breeding, they're on a frozen ocean. So they're not effectively on land. And they need that sea ice for as long as possible so that it'll form in the autumn when the conditions get cold enough. And then it will melt away the next spring and summer. And if that duration isn't long enough for them to lay their eggs and for the eggs to hatch and then the chicks to get to a certain stage, then, yeah, very quickly, I think we'll start to lose them. So, yeah, if the planet continues to warm, then I think penguins are going to be the first to get hit.
Mm. Do you think you'll ever go back to Antarctica?
Well, it's funny because a lot of people say, are you not bored of emperors now? And absolutely not. It's funny. It's probably the animal I've seen the most of in my life, having spent a year
after not
there.
Seeing them at all before.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But there's a real chance I'll never, ever see another one. And that's a tricky thing to take. So I like to think I'll get a short summer trip down there and film them during the summer when I can get in and out without having to stay all winter. But I'll definitely not be doing another winter. I absolutely loved it, but I've lived my dream now and it wouldn't be fair on family. So fingers crossed I get another chance.
Are you telling your family now stories about penguins, your little baby boy?
Oh, all the time. I've got two boys now and penguins are a big part of their life. So I'll have to do my best to try and show them an emperor at some point in their life.
Wildlife filmographer Lindsay McRae's book is My Penguin Year, Life Among the Emperors. Lindsay McRae, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
I know you have the best intentions. You want to keep up with the impeachment hearings, but maybe you have a job. There will be hours of testimony from witnesses in the impeachment inquiry this week, and the NPR Politics podcast will be there every afternoon to keep you up to date on all the key moments. Listen daily.
More than half of U.S. inmates have a substance abuse disorder, according to the Department of Justice. And most jails don't have enough doctors to treat them, and the medications they need can also be abused. But a jail in Washington State is trying to solve these problems. KUOW's Amy Radel reports.
You should be drinking hot water all the way up until I reach you, okay?
At the Snohomish County Jail in Everett, just north of Seattle, a medical assistant hands a line of inmates a small plastic cup containing a dose of buprenorphine and checks that they've swallowed it. The dose kills their cravings for opioids and prevents withdrawal, but it's still rare to offer it in jail. To cut down on diversion of the drug, all the inmates receiving it here are housed together. Jordan and Jesse, who just gave their first names to protect their privacy, are two of them. They say it helps build community.
We're comfortable with each other because, like, we all know that we're all struggling with the same thing. So
it's more of a brotherhood type of thing in here, you know, because this is a really big privilege that we have.
Jesse says he's been in the jail for 6 weeks. He'll continue his treatment when he's released in a few days. Snohomish County started offering the medication in a pilot program earlier this year. In September, they broadened it to every eligible inmate. About 500 inmates have received the treatment so far. The jail's bureau chief, Jamie Kane, says the effort started 5 years ago when they were flooded with inmates in withdrawal.
There's four to a cell on the floor. They're constantly vomiting. They have to share one toilet. It is not a good environment for anybody.
At first, all the staff could give inmates to ease withdrawal symptoms was Gatorade. But they worked with outside healthcare providers to expand access to buprenorphine. Healthcare Administrator Alta Langdon says now anyone in jail for a day or more can get help with treatment.
As a nurse practitioner, I want to follow best practice. And best practice is starting people on medication, maintaining their medication, and connecting them to community resources.
23-year-old Dale Erickson was part of the pilot program. He made the transition to treatment with the help of jail staff when he was released last June.
I have a job, I have stable housing, I have a better relationship with my parents and my family.
Erickson says he started using heroin when he was 16 and spent years in the criminal justice system's revolving door.
I have 3 felonies and 32 misdemeanors, and I can honestly say that every single charge was drug-related.
He credits his time in jail as motivating him to enter treatment. The jail's treatment providers also did one very basic thing. They gave Erickson a ride to his appointments, which he says was crucial.
They have somebody there to pick you up and actually take you to your first appointment to meet your doctor.
The medication-assisted treatment program in Snohomish County is paid for through private health insurance, Medicaid, and state and federal grants. The general fund pays for the medication, which jail bureau chief Kane says is well worth it.
Quite frankly, at less than $1 a day, we can't afford not to.
Officials say they plan to gather data on whether jail inmates continue with treatment and whether they reoffend in the future. Kane says for now, he at least knows the special housing units are calmer and less chaotic than the general population, and the medical unit has fewer inmates in withdrawal.
One thing we can say for certain is that our ability to safely and humanely house arrestees in our facility is light years ahead of where we were a year ago, definitely 5 years ago.
2 other counties in Washington are now providing this type of treatment. A third also hopes to offer it by the end of the year. For Here and Now, I'm Amy Radel.
As we learn more about President Trump's dealings in Ukraine and the ongoing impeachment inquiry, this week could also reveal more about the inner workings of the White House. The highly anticipated tell-all book by an anonymous senior official in the administration is set to be released tomorrow. Last year, this unidentified official wrote a revealing op-ed in the New York Times about growing opposition to the president. And while some may pore over what are expected to be alarming details, others will be fixated on decoding the author's identity through the book's use of vocabulary and language patterns, otherwise known as forensic linguistics. Kavitha Pillay is the co-host of a podcast, Subtitle, which takes a deep dive into languages and the people who speak them. Hi, Kavitha.
Hey, Tanya. Thanks for having me.
So forensic linguistics, that was the topic of one of your latest episodes. It sounds very Law and Order SVU. What is it?
Exactly. I think when people hear a word like forensic, they're probably evoking exactly something like that, something like from CSI. But forensic linguistics is rooted in this basic idea that you and I and everyone you know has a distinct way of using language, of speaking and writing. So a forensic linguist can look at those patterns of speech in a person and figure out things that you may not expect, your level of education, the kind of work you do, where you grew up, and then apply those patterns and that understanding that also a linguist would have and apply it to a legal setting. So, you know, a shorthand way of thinking of it might be linguistic DNA or linguistic fingerprint.
Mm-hmm. This is all so fascinating. The anonymous writer who wrote a 2018 op-ed about the White House and the Trump administration used the word lodestar, which is not a common word. According to the dictionary, it's a noun that means, quote, one that serves as an inspiration, model, or guide. And you say there's one particular person in the Trump administration who actually uses this word a lot.
Right. Lodestar, not an everyday term, and that Mike Pence has used that word with some frequency. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in a 965-word op-ed, a shiny word like that is going to stand out. And it had a lot of people pointing at Mike Pence as the possible author. But a forensic linguist might look at something like that and say, is that a linguistic smokescreen?
Yeah, like, is this taking the trail off of me?
Exactly.
Or does it really show maybe a geographical overlay, like that word might be used in places in the Midwest, for instance, or something like that?
Right. It might be. Who knows? I mean, that was only 965 words. But now on November 19th, they're going to have a lot more to analyze. And I actually think the interesting question is of the editor of the book, because typically an editor is trying to preserve someone's voice and identity. Mm-hmm. But the editor of a book like this, someone who's trying to remain anonymous, would have to kind of blur certain things that might point out who it is.
Let's get down to the science of forensic linguistics. It's been around for a long time. I remember they used this method to zero in on the Unabomber in the 90s.
Our other major story tonight, a break in the Unabomber case. FBI agents are searching the Montana cabin of former mathematics professor Ted Kaczynski. Just moments ago, we received these pictures of the suspect in custody, sitting in the back of a white truck.
Okay, we were all pretty fascinated with how detectives were able to use Kaczynski's manifesto. Remind us about that.
So the Unabomber, he was so careful not to leave fingerprints or any kind of DNA evidence, but he wrote this 35,000-word manifesto, and it became the strongest evidence against him. And it was the first time that a judge granted a search warrant based solely on linguistic evidence.
Let's listen to some of the words he used.
He referred to women as broads.
Right.
He referred to black people as Negroes. So it obviously, you know, put him in a sort of, you know, coming of age somewhere in the, before the civil rights movement.
So tell me what that means here. I mean, you talk about it could be a smokescreen, but it also can zero very much in on a person's life.
Right. You know, he used particular phrases that linguists were able to say probably put him having grown up in Chicago. He also did use some linguistic smokescreens. Like, this is a guy who went to Harvard and who had a PhD, and he used phrases like, I think there was once or twice where he was trying to portray himself as someone who did not have advanced degrees. And so linguists looking at that said, does he not have an advanced degree, or is it a smokescreen?
Yeah, I actually read about a case several years ago where a suspect used a smokescreen by misspelling words on purpose, but in fact, that actually led them to someone very specific. I believe it was a town in the Midwest because of a street, a geographical location, which only a few suspects who were on a list would know about that area. So that's super interesting. I want to know, do all forensic linguists use the same method to analyze vocabulary and language patterns? And really, how has technology advanced this field?
So some forensic linguists, you know, rely on the tools of traditional linguists, and some are more reliant on computational methods, and most are probably using a combination. You know, it may be a bit like translation. You know, if you use something like Google Translate or other translation software, it's a great tool. It's getting better all the time. But if you're trying to translate something of any length or depth or meaning, you're going to need some human involvement as well. So the tools of forensic linguistics are ever expanding because of things like AI. But forensic linguistics as a field is still heavily dependent on humans to guide it.
Yeah. We're talking about this in the scope of criminal cases, but does it play a role in cracking down on other things like hate speech or online bullying?
Right. Well, I think most people probably don't think that a word like forensic or linguistics applies to their life. But if you work in a company and they're using a software to keep track of your emails and to read your emails and such, that's an everyday form of forensic linguistics, right? It's being used on messaging services. Think about how Facebook or Twitter are using it to scan for certain types of messages and sometimes getting false positives. You know, there was a case recently where a woman on Twitter in German made a reference to the phrase, okay, boomer, but she used the word D-I-E, which is pronounced D as in the boomers, D-boomers. But in English, it's D-I-E, it's die. So for the Twitter algorithm, it looked like she was making a threat against boomers, and they kicked her off Twitter for half a day or so. But I think probably the most timely example is legislation that Senator John Cornyn of Texas has proposed. It's called the Response Act, and it's in response to the mass shootings that took place in Texas. And that would require certain schools receiving federal funds to use software to look at things like students' emails and assignments and social media. So if they're using, quote, trigger words, that might indicate that they're planning a mass shooting. You know, of course, there's all sorts of privacy issues. And you might get a lot of false positives. I mean, how many times do kids say things like, I'm going to kill her, or, oh, my God, I'm going to die? Like, is that going to
produce? Shorthand on, yeah, on social, and their shorthand in text. I'm a little afraid of that. I don't know about that.
Yeah.
You all have taken a deep dive into forensic linguistics. Where do you see this in the future?
I think whether or not we're aware of it, it's certainly something that's entering our lives, you know, whether it's work email being monitored or social media. But one situation that I hadn't thought of it being applied in is asylum cases. So if someone is saying that they're from a particular part of the world, it might be applied for something like that to show, are the terms that they're using actually indicative of them being from this particular part of the world? So there's a lot of different applications.
Well, a lot of people will be reading this new book by this anonymous senior official, and I'm sure that it will be going through a lot of technological programs that will actually try to pinpoint who this person is.
Right. A lot of eyes are going to be on it. It may be one of these things that it doesn't come down to forensic linguists. It might just be something they say that places them in a particular room, and then it's a process of elimination. Who knows?
That's Kavita Pillay. She is co-host of the podcast Subtitle on the Science of Forensic Linguistics. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And there will be a lot of rhetoric on Capitol Hill this week as more people testify in the impeachment inquiry. Tomorrow, lawmakers will hear from Alexander Vindman, the top Ukraine specialist on the National Security Council, Jennifer Williams, who is a foreign service aide working in the office of Vice President Pence, and former National Security Council aide Tim Morrison. All of them listened to President Trump's July 25th phone call with Ukraine's president, and they have offered different interpretations of that conversation. Also testifying tomorrow, former special envoy to Ukraine, Kurt Volker. We will be following all of that testimony closely.
It is time for a wealth tax in America.
It's Elizabeth Warren's new CNBC ad. Her campaign is also selling a $25 mug with the words, Billionaire Tears, a reference to the tears shed by former Goldman Sachs executive, current Omega Advisor CEO, Leon Cooperman. Now, Warren calls out him and other CEOs in a new video. Earlier this month, he was asked on CNBC about her candidacy and said this.
What she's peddling is bull, total, complete bull. You know, and by the way, that comes from somebody who believes in the progressive income tax structure, who believes the rich should pay more.
He then went on to talk about the state of the country and Donald Trump in a not-so-positive way, and those tears were shed. Elizabeth Warren is running against one billionaire, Tom Steyer. Another, Michael Bloomberg, is considering running. Some analysts say because Warren is scaring away wealthy Democrats. So how is her message going? Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington, as he does every Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hello.
And people can look at the video themselves. We'll post it. You know, he seems to be just kind of crumpling at the notion of a lot of different things. But here we have Elizabeth Warren's campaign selling these mugs, her backers, her followers saying you can drink a cup of the warm tears of the billionaires. How's that going over?
How's it going over? Well, let's talk about the plan first. So in a revised plan in order to fund her Medicare for All policy, she called for a 6% annual tax on net worth over $1 billion. And then also for the top percentile, she said she wants to treat investment income, capital gains, essentially more like annual income, which would be taxed annually. So you get into the nitty gritty of it. How is it going to work? Whether it's constitutional in the first place? That conversation is admittedly a bit dry. It's very numerical. So she's serving the vegetables of punitive public policy here with a spicy sauce of calling out specific billionaires like Lloyd Blankfein, former CEO of Goldman Sachs. And the strategy here, I would say, is to appeal specifically to two groups. One, those who support higher taxes on the rich in general, which is a pretty large constituency, and those who crave extraordinary detail in their policy proposals during the primary. That's a smaller constituency, but it's a powerful one because it includes the media. The media, especially wonky media, loves numbers to chew on. So she's serving these dishes to both constituencies, and it should be said, it is somewhat working for her. Her polls have soared in the last 6 months, even though they stabilized in the last few weeks.
Well, look, there's a huge inequity right now, a huge gap between these many new billionaires in the United States and people who haven't seen their wages change. So that does exist. But is she also doing a little bit of what the Wall Street Journal editorial page, which is, of course, very far to the right, is saying? They're calling this demagoguery 101. I mean, and when they point to Cooperman, Leon Cooperman, who she mentions in this video, you know, they say, as we just heard, he's somebody who actually says the rich should pay more. Is this demonizing people because you know Some people will be thrilled about that.
Yeah, I think it's useful to divide the reaction to this policy in three groups. First, a lot of people love it. Warren, after all, is the betting favorite in the Democratic primary, and her polls have soared in the last 6 months. So you can't really look at the situation and say it's not working for her because something she's doing is so clearly working. But second, there is this group, which the Wall Street Journal represents, which simply thinks it's deplorable to talk about successful people this way. You should not want to demonize the rich because, after all, we're a country where people move here with the hopes of getting rich. So why demonize the success? Third, I think we've begun to see a kind of sensitive billionaire response. There was that famous Bill Gates joking comment in a New York Times event interview where he said he'd be happy to double his tax burden, but he didn't want to increase it by an order of magnitude from $10 billion to $100 billion. And so what I think you see there is a moderate lane that appears to be opening up, maybe for people like Deval Patrick and Michael Bloomberg to argue, yes, of course we are fans of progressive taxation. Yes, of course we should raise taxes by a little bit on the wealthy. But talking about a wealth tax to essentially soak the rich for tens of billions of dollars over the course of a decade, that is a bridge too far.
Well, and some of the language, I mean, you just mentioned some of it, but some of the language that we hear from both Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and others, Tom Steyer, who's calling for taxing billionaires more. You hear language like they've sucked out profits in a rigged system, and this is the Wall Street Journal noting this, putting the economy in a stranglehold. It is that kind of language that they're pointing out. Can't you just say that we need to adjust the system? But that probably wouldn't be as exciting out of the campaign trail.
Right. I think it's fair to say that right now in the Democratic primary, there is a bias toward bigness, that those candidates that have played it really, really small ball and said, oh, I think we should tinker a little bit over here and tinker a little bit over there, they haven't caught fire. What's caught fire are huge, huge proposals to entirely change the way we pay for health care with Medicare for All, to entirely change the way we tax the rich with wealth taxes that Warren and Bernie Sanders have proposed, or frankly, ideas like Pete Buttigieg was initially talking about when he started his campaign, talking about expanding the Supreme Court and maybe taking away the filibuster. There is a bias toward bigness in the world right now, maybe because of social media or the difficulty of getting attention of a distracted voting audience. And bigness is winning.
Well, and we'll see how it plays out. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And listeners, again, let us know if you've got your billionaire tears cup or if you find that a little rude. Here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
The impeachment hearings go into their second week with testimony expected from 8 current and former Trump administration officials.
And President Trump says he's considering testifying in writing to the committee after the House invited his testimony.
We will have all the latest next time, Here and Now.